Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Nathan Bomey. He's a reporter for USA Today and the author, most recently, of Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. And you can learn more at nathanbomey.com. That's Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, Bomey, B-O-M-E-Y, all one word, nathanbomey.com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Let me just say that as we continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you to continue to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, staying home, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation that has taken place. By taking decision-making out of the hands of party leaders in smoke-filled rooms, primary elections were adopted to make campaigns more small-d democratic. And perhaps they do, but by giving disproportionate power to the most extreme elements in both parties, they make politics and government less so. And as we've made clear on this show many times, minority rule through such tactics as gerrymandering and voter suppression is a huge challenge in the U.S. But even without minority rule, the fact that the people of this country agree more with each other than their representatives do is a problem. How do we overcome that systemic flaw in our process in time to deal with the crises we face? I believe we face a number of existential crises: climate, pandemics, nuclear weapons, weakened democracy, rampant inequality, potential technological disruption, and systemic racism. And that we wasted at least the 4 years of the Trump administration, and realistically more than that when we add the time it'll now take to reconstruct and repair government efforts to move us forward. Given all of this, I was immediately intrigued when I learned of Nathan Bomey's new book, Bridge Builders. I'm eager to learn of the efforts he's discovered, mostly under the radar, far away from the headlines and the spotlights of political media. From clergy fighting racism in Charlottesville, to a former Republican congressman engaging conservatives on climate change, Appalachian journalists restoring social trust with the public. In Bridge Builders, Nathan explores the transformational ways in which committed citizens are combating polarization by pursuing reconciliation, rejecting misinformation, and rethinking the whole principle of compromise. Nathan Bomey covers business news, the automotive industry, bankruptcy, and misinformation at USA Today. He's principal scriptwriter on a full-length documentary film on Detroit's bankruptcy. His books include Detroit Resurrected, To Bankruptcy and Back, After the Fact, The Erosion of Truth and the Inevitable Rise of Donald Trump, and his latest, Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. Welcome, Nathan Bomey, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thanks so much for having me.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, April 13th. So first of all, how are you? How are you and your family, your loved ones, and so on, coping with the pandemic?
Well, we're hanging in there. You know, it's been a tough ride for everybody. It's certainly been tough in journalism. You know, an incredibly stressful year in 2020 to be in journalism, but also incredibly dynamic and certainly no complaints. Thrilled to still be in journalism.
Michigan has been in the news even very recently with a resurgence. How is that?
Well, my home state is, you know, it's been a real challenging, and I'm not exactly sure why cases spiked in April for Michigan, but I know that it's been a very difficult time since the beginning. You know, I worked in Detroit for several years, worked in Ann Arbor for several years. I'm from Michigan. My family still lives there. And, you know, Michigan being really a purple state at this point has had quite a struggle, you know, between the left and the right over how much to shut down and how much to open up. And Governor Whitmer has certainly been in the crosshairs there. And it's, yeah, it's been an incredibly tumultuous time. And I think that there's a lot of COVID-19 fatigue out there, but especially in Michigan. And I do wonder if that's contributing to the spike in cases there.
So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So tell us a bit about your path, how you see your path to the work you do today, and feel free to go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, I started in journalism at age 17, actually, in high school. I knew I wanted to be a journalist from a young age, and I know that's pretty strange, but I actually ended up doing freelance for my local community newspaper, working for my student paper in high school, and, you know, but as a professional journalist at age 17, they send me to the local township board of trustees, and I'm sitting there, you know, trying to figure out what a septic system zoning, you know, requirements, what is this debate all about? How do I translate this into a story that the public actually cares about? And, you know, really mundane kind of journalism, but actually important on a local level. And it taught me the nuts and bolts of journalism and how and why journalism is critical to a healthy democracy. And so that was, you know, 2001. Now it's 2021. So I guess I've been in journalism for 20 years, which is so weird. And
indeed,
you know, it's changed so much. And so it feels strange to say that at age 37, I've seen journalism go from a point at which I was using a Canon AE-1 film camera to take pictures at high school sporting events to a point in, you know, where I'm at USA Today now. We're talking about, you know, why the facts still matter in our society, you know. And so the arc of my career has been, you know, very tumultuous from that perspective, but also very dynamic and you know, exciting to see how we can still make an impact as journalists.
Now, a couple of things I want to say about that. One is a question, just when you were working at 17, were you actually a paid reporter?
Yeah, I was. I was actually getting. I got paid $7.50 an hour to cover the news, and you know, I just remember being so proud of the fact that I'm working for the Saline Reporter in Saline, Michigan, just south of Ann Arbor, and you know, and that people would pay 50 cents for the right for me to sit there for 4 hours and to sort through this, you know, crazy Lodi Township Board of Trustees meeting and try to distill it all into 450 words. And it was such a public service, and I was so enamored with that whole concept. And you know, I was doing high school sports stories and feature stories, and just understanding how central healthy newspaper could actually be to a local community. And that's why I'm so passionate about the importance of local journalism in American society and how we've lost it to a great extent.
Yeah, no, that's the point I was going to make, is that your book makes clear the importance you feel of local journalism and of local people telling the stories of local issues. And so it's neat to hear that it comes from, you know, on the ground work when you were in your teens.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm in some ways uniquely positioned to be able to make that case, because I did start on such a local level, and now I am a national journalist. And so I can sort of say, national journalist often shouldn't be the ones telling local stories. We have this huge crisis where national journalists often parachute into local communities and then do a very poor job of capturing the local stories. And so I got to interview a group called 100 Days in Appalachia for this book, and they're doing very grassroots journalism throughout Appalachia, and they're trying to capture local stories in a very authentic way. Because, you know, in the 2016 election, in particular in the aftermath when Donald Trump had prevailed and everyone descended upon Appalachia to meet all these people who voted for Donald Trump, and we have to meet these strange aliens.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of embarrassing, you know, for us as journalists, that we were shocked and awed that these people actually existed. And so what this group is doing is trying to restore trust between people in Appalachia who had lost trust in the media, in a lot of cases for reasons that are not legitimate, you know. And because, of course, the president, you know, for 4 years spent time bashing us illegitimately as purveyors of fake news. But the point is, you know, we have made some mistakes, so we can't run from all of those mistakes. And so I feel passionately, Terrence, that we as journalists can be bridge builders. We can't be absent from this conversation about how we can stitch back together the bonds of social trust in this country.
Yeah, well, I mean, a journalist can obviously see the need, and then that that presents the challenge of, if you see the need, how do you fill the gap? How do you actually take that on in your work? One thing that I if that's the last time we talk about 100 Days in Appalachia, is obviously the name sounds like a finite organization. Tell us about that, that originally it was just going to be a snapshot of 100 days, right?
Yeah, they launched essentially saying we're going to cover the first 100 days of the Trump administration, and we're going to show how, you know, these authentic portraits of people in Appalachia could give the country a real genuine understanding of many of the challenges, but also the opportunities and, you know, the people of that region. But they quickly gained traction and gained these partnerships with the places like The Guardian and Slate and, you know, these international, in many cases, media outlets that said, we need to have a presence in these local communities, and we have to partner with local journalists to do it. And I talked to them, and they felt the pain, the sting of a lot of the poor representation, the misrepresentation. For example, the fact that in the sense that everybody is a Trump supporter in West Virginia, you know, where at the heart of Appalachia, and having visited, you know, the people there, you know, you talk to them and they say, no, you know, listen, we have LGBTQ communities here. We have Muslim voters here. You know, why aren't people featuring some of these voices? And so the loss of nuance in a lot of media, I think, is a real issue. And of course, the central reason is social media, which basically is a complete betrayal of nuance. And so I think we as journalists have to get beyond our headline culture and start to dive into nuance and embrace it if we want to start to regenerate trust.
Very good. So you and your work may be new to a lot of my listeners, Nathan. So can you talk a bit about your previous two books, Detroit Resurrected and After the Fact? And do you sense there are some common themes or perhaps a perspective that evolves through the three books?
You know, I actually think there is, and it's a great question, and I appreciate it. And because in some sense, my first book probably looks like an outlier at this point, but it stemmed from my coverage at the Detroit Free Press of the Detroit bankruptcy, which was the largest Chapter 9 bankruptcy in U.S. history. You know, $18 billion in debt, 170,000 creditors, 32,000 pensioners, you know, 66,000 pieces of art that were at risk of being liquidated to help pay off creditors. It was a crazy, dynamic story with fascinating characters and implications, you know, in so many areas, law, politics, philanthropy, just really amazing implications. And so, you know, and of course, the story of Detroit is the story in many ways of America. You know, the rise of the middle class stems from Detroit. And, you know, the Henry Ford and the $5 wage, the clash of you know, police and Black Americans in the 1960s that gave rise to the rebellion of 1967, and, you know, and in many ways of foreshadowing a lot of the issues we have today. So, you know, Detroit is a place that everyone has an opinion about, you know, and I tried to give tried to tell the story, the inside story of the Detroit bankruptcy. But what that story was fundamentally about was a story about compromise. It was a story about how do you address, what do you do when a great American city goes broke? And we can sit around debating the issues, you know, forever if we want to, and it's all relevant, but what do you do going forward? And how do you bring people to the table, Republicans and Democrats, you know, white folks and Black folks, and across the board, people who have despised each other for so long, and they have to come to some sort of agreement on what to do with this city going forward. And so that was sort of the fundamental premise of that book. And in some ways, it did inspire my second book, which was After the Fact, where I basically had a chance to chronicle the age of misinformation and why it set the stage for Donald Trump to rise to power and not the other way around. So, you know, because that book is really about my own observations in many ways of how the facts increasingly don't matter to a lot of people as much as we wish that they did.
Okay, very good. And what is the stimulus for this book? Was there a specific moment when you knew, this is the next one, this is what I've got to spend a couple of years on?
Yeah, this was, honestly, this is a sequel to my second book in a way. It directly stems from the experience of writing after the fact, because after I came out of that book, which I was very proud of, and honestly, I had the experience, and actually I know some people who read it had the same experience, which was, it's kind of depressing in a way. So I hate to throw my own book under the bus, but you know, you spend as long as I did exploring how much the truth has eroded in many quarters of society, and how it does not guide decision-making and does not guide our thinking in so many ways. And you become pretty, you really become to believe that it is, that we are so terribly polarized that nothing can be done about it. And I said to myself, I can't accept that. You know, I can't accept the idea that we are forever entrenched in this incredibly polarized position. And so I said, I've got to go out and meet people who are not accepting the status quo. And I've got to go out and meet people who are bridging divides, who are bringing people together despite their differences, whether it's politics, race, religion, class, culture, pretty much anything that's dividing Americans. I've got to meet people who are not accepting the status quo. And so that's what I did. And I spent basically about a year doing that and writing about it before I even had a book deal, because I knew I wanted to be able to start telling these stories and bringing these stories together before I even tried to go out and get a publisher.
And did you know that these people existed? Had you come across them in the past, or was your initial, you know, exploration hopeful, but not necessarily knowing that you'd find what you were hoping?
You know, I wasn't sure. I'll say this. There were areas where I was more optimistic than others, you know, and, you know, so for example, one area where I was very pessimistic was, and it turned out to be correctly so, was I knew I wanted to do a chapter that featured an organization or people who were using social media in some capacity to bring people together. And I thought, this is going to be tough. And it was very difficult, because I honestly, there aren't that many people who are using social media in that capacity. And there are people who are doing positive things on social media, but not very many who are using it for the purpose of bringing people together in some capacity. So that took a while. And that's one of the reasons I didn't want to pursue a publisher at the beginning, because I knew I had to take this process organically. I couldn't force it. You can't just Google bridge builders and, like, you know, find the people who you want to feature. I am an older millennial, Terrence, but I recognize that Google can't solve all our problems.
So let me, by the way, I'm going to take on something which I, all of these numbers I'm about to say, I found in your book, but I just want to lay out, the numbers that demonstrate the problem we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So these are various polls, and the book is footnoted, and there's no question, you know, these things come from very legitimate polls, but here's numbers. 61% of Democrats see Republicans as racist, bigoted, and sexist. 61%. 54% of Republicans see Democrats as spiteful. 49% of them see them as ignorant. Almost one-fifth of Democrats and one-fifth of Republicans see the other side as evil. Now, that's one in five of each side sees the other side as evil. Among both Democrats and Republicans, only 2 to 3% see the other side as kind, which that's one that really blows my mind, because I know people that I disagree with, but I see them be good fathers and mothers and that sort of thing. So that's really something, that only 2 to 3% see the other side as kind. And no more than 4% see the other side as thoughtful. 87% of Democrats and 84% of Republicans say the other side is hateful. 87 and 84. I mean, that is overwhelming. 88% of both Democrats and Republicans say the other side is brainwashed. And I think that's one that in a way almost doesn't surprise me, because it sure makes it easier to discount what someone says if you assume they're brainwashed. Democrats and Republicans imagine, and this is a good one, that almost twice as many people on the other side hold the extreme views. In other words, the thing I referred to in the beginning, where primaries seem to play to the extremes, the extreme bases of both parties. And I mean, they do. It's not just, you know, that's clear. But one of the things that you will get is that so a candidate will run against the extreme of the other party. But here's how off people's perceptions are. Democrats underestimate the number of Republicans who believe that many Muslims are good Americans by 29 points. They underestimate percentage of Republicans who believe that properly controlled immigration can be a good thing for America by 33 points. Republicans overestimate the percent of Democrats who believe that the U.S. should have completely open borders by 33 points, and overestimate the percentage of Democrats who believe America should be socialist by 25 points. So that's, I mean, that's one that's really sort of I think very interesting to see. It's that we perceive the other as much more other than they are when it comes to parties. Finally, progressive activists on the left, devoted conservatives on the right, make up only 8% and 6% of Americans respectively. They are really small minorities, and yet in the media, in the perception, they become the face of the other party. Here's the one that sort of is the taking off point for your book. 67% of Americans constitute an exhausted majority. Yeah. Distinct groups of people with varying degrees of political understanding and activism who share a sense of fatigue with the polarized national conversation, a willingness to be flexible in their political viewpoints, and the feeling that they lack a voice in the national conversation. 67%. That's 2 out of every 3 Americans is tired of polarization and willing to behave in ways that could counter it. Now, that piece of information, whenever you came across it, must have been heartening for the job you were taking on.
It is. And, you know, the first set of stats you cited was, of course, the reason to believe we're doomed. And then the second set of stats is the reason to believe there's cause for optimism, you know, because we have this crisis of what political scientists call affective polarization, where you don't just dislike the other side because of their ideas or their beliefs. You dislike them because of who they are. And that's a huge problem, because that basically presents the idea that no matter what, you're going to hate the other side. And that's the central reason for the tribalism that we have in this country. And it sort of is why you can see, you can identify people often based on things that don't have anything to do with their political beliefs, because the tribes can, you know, start to conform to each other. I think the problem, though, Terrence, is to cite Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, from one of the Star Wars movies. He said, you know, only a Sith deals in absolutes, you know, and I don't want to be a Darth Vader. So the point is that, you know, any of those views where you say the other side is evil, the other side is this, the other side is that, is often going to, again, be a betrayal of nuance. And, you know, I think one of the real encouraging things I found in this book is in interviewing people who are trying to overcome these divides is that they don't label people. And I think that is interesting. They understand that people have flaws. You know, bridge builders are not Pollyannish. They understand that people are broken or, you know, messed up in various ways and have personality flaws, have issues, and even sometimes hate. But, you know, they also have these aspirational views of people, and they aren't going to label them, because they realize that when you label people, then that just generates a counterproductive response, and then the person simply won't engage with you. And ultimately we have to engage with people if we want to make progress, because our system in this country is built on the need to work with each other. And so I think that those labels are really central to why we have these issues, but also understanding them is critical, because if we don't understand them, we won't be able to begin to address it.
You know, I found an interesting document online, which was you gave the commencement address.
Yeah.
At your high school in 2019, back when there were in-person commencements.
Right. Yeah, it was a true honor, I must say.
Oh, of course. Really, yeah. So tell me a little bit about, because you're in the middle of the research for this book at that point, I think,
yes.
Or maybe you've begun to write it. Tell me a little bit, tell listeners a little bit about what the points you felt most critical to make to a group of high school seniors And two, I'm assuming you got some response, some, tell me a little bit about that event.
You're right. I was in the middle of doing the book. I hadn't disclosed that yet, though, so it was a total secret, but you could see what was on my mind at the time. And the title of the speech was To Be a Bridge Builder. And the point was, you're going to go out into the world, I said to the high school students, and you're going to meet a lot of people who spend their time tearing other people apart and profit from it. And I didn't get specific about who I'm talking about, but it's obvious. You could probably see some people on cable news. You can probably see quite a lot of people in Washington. You can maybe see some people on Wall Street, and you can certainly see people in my own profession and digital journalism or print media as well, who are doing that. And I said, don't go out and be someone who profits off of tearing other people apart. We have enough of that in this country. Go out and try to work on bringing people together. And that doesn't, and being a bridge builder, and that doesn't mean that you ignore the problems or that you're weak or that it's a milquetoast kind of way of approaching things. My perspective, Terrence, is that it's countercultural, actually, that it is one of the most countercultural things you can do. You want to swim with the tide, then go ahead and do that. But I honestly think that if you go counterculturally, you will. That's how you can really make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things you're saying is, and I think it's at a very interesting inflection point for those who are about to go into the job world or to the college world, is make friendships with people unlike you, people with different life experiences, because so up until this point, their relationships have been with their family and their school friends and maybe their church friends and maybe their athletic team friends. And you're now saying you're about to go into a bigger world. Don't just stay in line.
Yes, exactly. I think that is critical. And that is actually the fundamental through line of my book, because I really believe strongly that relationships between people of difference is one of, if not the only, fundamental ways we can begin to overcome polarization along all sorts of lines. Because the problem is, we still live in a segregated country, Terrence. I mean, it's politically, racially, culturally, economically, we are segregated in this country. And so what oftentimes that leads to further division and further distrust. And if we don't break down those barriers, then people don't get to know each other. They don't have conversations with people who aren't like them. They don't have those relationships. Then that the bonds of trust can never be reconstructed. And, I think it is interesting, because when you look at one of the very modest suggestions I make in the conclusion of this book is that, for example, colleges should stop letting freshmen pick their roommates before they go to college. I mean, this is a very small thing, but you know what happens when you let college freshmen choose their roommates before they go to college? They end up picking other people just like them. And oftentimes it's rich kids find the rich kids, mm-hmm. And so how is that going to help? So those are just small things, but I think the culture of relationship building is actually something that can be integrated into our political decision-making and our institutional frameworks to start to break down some of these barriers.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I'm going to share my own experience. I did not choose my roommates. I went to college in 1965. So middle of the 60s, graduated in 69, one of the peak years of activism. Yeah. I was in a suite of six, a black student from Denver, Colorado, two Orthodox Jews. How did that happen? Perhaps they both asked to have an Orthodox Jew roommate, an atheist from Hawaii. Myself and one other who was just sort of a normal WASP guy from Maryland. But that really set the tone, if you will, for kind of what I expected college life to be. I was a kid from a small town in Florida. And this was a big eye opener. I did want to say, so you gave the commencement address. What were some of the responses you got from some of the students?
Oh, you know, I was very positive, and but as the biggest response I got was from the teachers and even the school board members who said we needed a message like this in our community because, you know, I think that like any other community, my hometown, it deals with all kinds of conflict over, you know, social, cultural, you know, situations, and they realize that, you know, they're having the same kinds of debates that are happening across America, and how do we address these in a way that actually leads to something productive or leads to some sort of progress without, well, you can't really do that unless if you're just talking to this people who look like you, pray like you, think like you know, talk like you.
Right.
You can't do it. Like, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so that was, it was great feedback and a really fascinating experience. I'd never spoken to 3,000 people in person before, but you know, I'll tell you what, it is an invigorating experience.
Oh, and to be at your own high school. And how many years later was it? Was it
That would have been, let's see, so
18?
2002, 17 years.
Yeah, that's great. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Nathan Bomey. He's a reporter for USA Today, and we're talking about the ideas and the people in his new book, Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. You can learn more at nathanbomey.com. That's NathanBomey, Nathan Bomey, BOMEY, NathanBomey, one word, .com. And you can follow him on Twitter at NathanBomey. Let's talk about some of the groups you found. And let me give you a suggestion of how I'd like you to talk about them, which is what's working, why is it working, right? In each, and pick, maybe a couple of the community groups, a journalism group, that sort of thing, some that jump out to you. I mean, I'm just looking at Braver Angels coming to the table, 100 day, we already talked about 100 days in Appalachia. Everyday Projects, I thought, was really an interesting one. Go ahead.
Well, I think Braver Angels is a really interesting example of a group that is not accepting the status quo and is certainly swimming upstream. This is a group that actually started with the name Better Angels, of course, deriving from the Abraham Lincoln speech and the Better Angels of Our Nature. And the goal that they formed in the aftermath of the 2016 election was, how can we bring, basically, they call them reds and blues, essentially Republicans and Democrats, together to have a, you know, effective conversation about political issues. And they have been basically going through that process, and now they've gotten to the point where they have tens of thousands of dues-paying members, and they're doing clinics essentially throughout the country. They're teaching people how to talk to each other, which is something I never thought we would have to experience in this country, but it's certainly, certainly, I think, fair to say that we've gotten to that point where it's necessary. But what I find so interesting about Braver Angels is that they don't actually care if people reach an agreement. That's not the point of what they're doing. The point is not to say, let's reach some middle ground. And their point is actually to say, we need to reestablish social trust, or maybe you could call it civic trust, in the sense where I can see you as a human being. I see you as someone who is worthy of talking to, and someone who is worthy of, you know, of experiencing progress in some capacity, someone who's, you know, whose future matters to me. And I think to the book by book See No Stranger by Valerie Kaur, the Sikh civil rights activist whose quote in that book is, "You are a part of me I do not yet know." And, you know, the idea that, like, we are all in this sort of the inescapable, you know, web of mutuality. I think I to mangle the MLK quote there. You know, it's we your future is critical to my future. And that's why bridge building is so important. And I think one of the misnomers about bridge building is that we have to meet in the middle. That is absolutely not the case. And Braver Angels understands that we don't have to get people to meet in the middle. But, you know, in talking to them, you know, it underscores this point that actually real world bridge builders have made that I talked
Yes,
to for
yes,
this
yes,
book.
yes.
It's that there are different processes for building bridges. You know, there isn't one way to do it. And oftentimes you don't build it from one side and the other side to meet squarely in the middle. It's not the way it works. You know what? Sometimes one side is right and the other side is wrong. That's just a fact, and we can't escape that. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to bridge to bridge the gap. So Braver Angels is a fascinating group. Yeah, another one is...
Oh, let me just say one other thing about them, which is that you pointed out the goal is not that we meet in the middle. If I'm not mistaken, they also make the point, the goal is not even to necessarily talk that much about policy or to come up with, you know, policy. I mean, it's more about the very nature of being with another person and listening. And I have long said that I believe the thing that human beings, once their very basic needs are taken care of, the thing that human beings want more than anything is to feel seen and heard.
Yeah.
Whether it's your parents, your partner, your colleagues, and so on. And that's really what they're setting out to do.
I couldn't agree more. And, it's, one of the points I make in the conclusion of this book is one of the common qualities between bridge builders of all stripes is that they listen when most people would talk.
Yes.
And, it sounds really cliche, but it's so true. And it's why? Because when you show someone else that you care, when you show someone else that you actually, that they are heard, like you just said, that they are seen, then they feel like that you're invested in them. And then what happens? Then they care about you too. And so all of a sudden, it's kind of like this sort of selfish way. That's the funny thing about bridge building. You can be selfish in the sense that, I'm going into this because I want progress for the things I care about. But if I want progress for the things that I care about, then I have to show someone else I care about them too.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea that we have to completely compromise our values and give in and, just compromise what we believe in. But no, the reality is that we don't have to split the baby in half, apologies to King Solomon.
Yeah.
I appreciate what he tried to do with that compromise, but the reality is we don't have to look at it that way.
The goal is really to create a foundation on which many things are possible. But it's that foundation that is their work. Exactly. Okay, take on another one.
Well, I think the Everyday Projects is a very interesting example of a group that, again, I mentioned that social media is obviously this really toxic place where it doesn't seem like anything positive is happening. And so I set out, though, in writing this book to find a group or an organization or a person who is using social media in some capacity to bring people together. And that's what I found in the Everyday Projects, which is loosely called a group. It's a very somewhat informal, but it is technically a nonprofit, but it's essentially this umbrella group that oversees social media or sites, more or less Instagram pages, Instagram accounts, that are trying to basically present authentic images of communities throughout the world in ways that we don't usually see. And it started with these two journalists who were reporting in Africa on war-torn countries in the early 2000s and realizing that the images that they saw on a day-to-day basis of regular people in Africa doing regular things and having normal daily lives were not the kind of images that were presented in the media in America. And in America, you see poverty, you see famine, you see war, you see wildlife or something. But in reality, in so many African countries, it's actually more mundane. And the point was actually of Everyday Projects and Everyday Africa is to show mundane images because then that shows their humanity. It shows our shared humanity. It shows that, the divide between us and them is actually not an ocean. It's much smaller than that. And, we have differences, but those differences can be celebrated in the images that can connect us through their mundanity. So I find that to be fascinating. And they have found that, these images actually often do gain traction on social media where supposedly sensationalism is what works.
The algorithms like sensationalism, and yet it turns out these counter that.
Yeah, and I found that to be really interesting. And so what has happened since they started Everyday Africa is they've seen this very organic development of quote-unquote everyday accounts and all throughout the world. Now there are pretty much throughout every major community throughout the world, there is some sort of account that is essentially doing the same thing with hundreds of thousands and really at this point millions of followers that are trying to say, oh, look, here's someone in Ghana just making a cup of coffee this morning, you know, or here's someone in an elevator, here's someone fixing a car, you know, very small things. And so I got a chance to visit these kids, this is pre-pandemic, in Washington, D.C., these middle school students who basically did a everyday D.C. exhibition at a art gallery, and they essentially showed, here are the pictures of our Washington, you know, not the Washington you see on TV. And yes, they know that their community has challenges, but, you know, it's not the kind of it's not what people think it is. And so I find the idea that we can present authentic images on social media is actually a way to build bridges between people who otherwise don't understand each other.
Yeah, and a couple of things about that story, Nathan, that I want to mention is that if the way I read it was that when they originally, these two journalists working on crisis in Africa, started taking these everyday pictures, I don't even think they were originally even thinking about these are the ones we'll submit to our publication. It was just one of them just started taking pictures of someone drinking coffee, someone sitting at a desk, someone, you know, a couple doing, you know, being together, walking down the street. And it was when the two of them, the two journalists, kind of started looking at him and went, these are effective. These are moving. And so, I mean, it really grew from almost a whim to then become an international movement. There's something quite wonderful about that.
Yeah, it was really organic. It wasn't intentional at all. They just really just got frustrated with the fact that they were pitching stories to their editors that, you know, were getting rejected. And I think that's a lesson for my profession as journalists, to say, how can we start telling stories that often aren't told? You know, we go in to these war-torn countries and often tell war-torn stories. You know, it's this whole story about the hammer can only see a nail. And so, you know, I think we have to start thinking differently about what kind of stories can we tell that will, yes, not ignore the challenges, but also illustrate real human issues and commonalities at the same time as we show differences, because differences are important and they're good. But sometimes you have to show people how they also share things with each other to start helping them then actually also understand their differences.
Yeah, and it reminds me a bit of Humans of New York and that mm-hmm. another sort of movement where I believe someone just started taking pictures of people he would run into in New York and write a little paragraph about them. And it has I think, led to other people doing it all around the country or maybe even beyond that. And it's also interesting in that it's images, so it is really up to the viewer to decide what they see, what they feel, and so on. You know, there's a greater freedom almost with images than there is with copy or text.
Yeah, and I've spent most of this book really focusing on how real world relationships and real world conversation between people of difference is often what we need to break down barriers. But I also recognize and made the point that sometimes that's not enough and you need a different medium to do that. And I think art is a way to do that, because sometimes art is the way that you can communicate to people issues and problems that otherwise you may not be able to communicate. And so art projects, photography, it is important. Unfortunately, we need the social media companies to begin to highlight this kind of thing more often than they do, but it's probably a conversation for another day.
Yeah, no, setting aside as we will, the whole notion of just reprogramming those algorithms. It is, I mean, if someone had told us 10 years ago that, you know, everything that filled our perception and filled our mind and our images of what's what reality is was going to be dictated by an inhuman algorithm that was just, I've talked about it before, and as I said, we're not going to go into it, but that just is designed and engineered to tickle your dopamine, to tickle your neurotransmitters, or even, let's say, irritate your neurotransmitters, is sci-fi, and it happened. It is prevalent now, and we see hearings in Congress and so on, but I don't think we've seen any progress in really getting the those huge tech platforms to move off of their addiction to this. Speaking of tech platforms and so on, you also talk about MediaWise, because you say that conventional fact-checking is not necessarily going to work and that you've got to rethink fact-checking.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to make sure that I addressed in this book, you know, the crisis of how do we bring people together when we can't agree on the facts, you know, and that is something we can dive further into if you'd like. But when I wanted to talk to fact checkers who are deeply immersed in basically the front lines of where the truth is being bashed every day, and talk to them about how they help people reconnect with the truth. And, you know, the reality is that top-down fact-checking, you know, it's important because we have to correct the record. We have to get the truth out there. But when you really look at the research, you know, it doesn't really work in the sense that it doesn't get people on the same page about the facts. Like, it can help, but it doesn't make a huge difference because, you know, as they say, of course, the phrase goes, the truth gets, you know, the lie gets around the world before the truth is, up, you know, has gotten up for the day or whatever the phrase is. And so, you know, then the research actually backs that up, that lies ricochet around the internet for a long time before the truth catches up. So what I think we need to do, and what MediaWise and another group called the News Literacy Project are doing, is they're putting the emphasis on training people how to actually use the skills of journalists themselves, which is how to sort fact from fiction on your own. Because we can't really expect professional journalists, and clearly we can't expect the social media companies to do it. They aren't stepping up to the plate to do it. And so this is actually a very basic skill that you need as a citizen now. And so I think we have to think about this from an education perspective, that this is actually a core skill that you need. And you know what? I think that a lot of people actually do want to sort through the facts. You look at the research, people understand that we have a misinformation problem. And so they want the skills, but how can we expect them to do this when we don't teach it? And so, you know, I think that the folks who are trying to actually, it's sort of teach a man to fish instead of, you know, give him the fish. I think that's the right approach.
So in other words, checking the fact checker in the Washington Post is giving them a fish,
yes.
Teaching them how to do it. And just briefly, I, as I recall, you sort of lay out two or three steps. What are they? I mean,
it's honestly the basic skills of journalism. That's what's so interesting. Unfortunately, we can't send people to journalism school, can't send everyone to journalism school, unfortunately, but we can teach them the very basic skills of journalism, which I'm afraid to say my own job, you know, is pretty straightforward. It's just who is saying this, you know, and what's their evidence, and, you know, checking out the source. It's about source validation, you know? And I think this idea of lateral reading, the idea that once you see information, you can't just trust. So a lot of people just go to the About Us page, for example, and say, well, what is this organization? That's not really enough, because the About Us page could be warped. So you got to go to a different site. You got to go read laterally, and you have to read basically other trusted sources. You have to basically triangulate. And that's how you can actually authenticate sources. And so, you know, when I, as a reporter, I'm trying to validate information, I don't just trust the first person who says it to me. I have to validate that in some capacity. So we need to school people on how to do that as well.
Okay. I want to jump to some of your recommendations more strictly. And you say at one point, 5 keys to being a bridge builder, and these are based on the experience of the people that you interviewed. 1, acknowledge the past, educate others about it, and refuse to idealize it.
And I think that this is really important, because bridge builders, you know, don't ignore the past. And they in fact, they actually do the opposite. They investigate, explore the past, they teach people about it. And, you know, one person who really embodied this was Latasha Morrison, who was the head of a group called Be the Bridge. She wrote a fascinating book on the same title. And essentially, she's a Christian minister, but as a Black woman, she is going to white churches throughout America and basically speaking to, in often cases, white evangelical churches about how racism, white supremacy, and white privilege have endured and caused so much harm, and in often cases directly from the churches themselves and from Christians. And she's trying to say, you know, listen, I believe in the same God you believe. I read the same Bible you read, but you need to understand that this is something that you can't escape and something we have to talk about. And so she talks about the past, and she understands that this is critical to setting up a better future. You know, Isabel Wilkerson, in her amazing book, Cast, talks about how, you know, if you go to the doctor and talk about your, you know, about your ailment, the doctor doesn't ignore your history. That's the first question the doctor asks is, what's your
good
history?
Metaphor? Yeah.
Yeah. And I know I couldn't, I had to mention that because it's just a fascinating comparison. And so we can't ignore the past. We can't ignore the medical history. We have to talk about it, but big distinction here. There's a big distinction between blame and shame. And it's natural for us as humans to want to shame others, you know? But the problem is that, you know, we talked to Latasha Morrison. She says, no, shame draws the attention to me. It makes me feel better. But, it doesn't really accomplish much. We have to have blame because we have to know where the responsibility lies. But if we shame, it's just going to end up making things worse, you know? So we have to move past shame, and we have to believe, we believe in accountability, but we can only move on to talking about progress if we do this in the right way.
Then your second one is don't label people. We already talked about that. Your third one is embrace conflict.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this seems to link to what we just were talking about with not pretending, not erasing the past.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest misconceptions about bridge building is that it's just about creating some utopian society where everyone gets along. It's not the case at all. You know, I mean, it's not. And you talk to the people I talked to for this book, and they embrace conflict. You know, the question is, how do you approach it? You know, and I talked to Eboo Patel, who is the founder of a group called the Interfaith Youth Corps. You know, he's a Muslim man who is dedicated to trying to bridge gaps between people of different faiths. And he said to me, you know, you can't have a diverse democracy if, you know, if everyone has to agree on everything. And so the point is, you know, we can't. We have to agree to disagree. And that is becoming an anachronism for sure. But, you know, we have to understand that conflict is a natural part of the human experience. So the question is, how do we establish that social trust so that we can approach conflict in a productive way? Because you know what? Free people are going to disagree.
Yeah.
It's just going to happen. So we can't, President Biden has been talking a lot about the need for unity, and I appreciate that perspective, but I'm not sure unity is the right word. Mm-hmm. You know, conflict is okay, and actually we need it to move forward.
Yeah, to say that whether it's the pandemic, the economy, even racism and things like that, to say that we're in this together is not to say unity. It's to say we face the challenge together, given all the differences and the conflicts and so on. How are we going to solve this? One of my concerns is that, and I even referred to it in the introduction, is that while bridges exist between people, there's an overlap kind of in what we want for our children or what we want for our community and so on. They don't seem to me, and I think there's systemic reasons for this, to be reflected in our politics, our government, in the belt, you know, the world that exists inside the beltway, or political media. How is that going to change? And how does these individual people bridging their gaps going to translate into a national change or national movement?
Well, I think I need to start by saying I don't know if it will. I'm not sure it will.
And
I can't say that I have faith that it will. And that's where I have to be really honest and say, I'm not sure things will get better. What I wanted to do in this book is say, maybe here's how we can start the process. I'll start there, but I'll say this. I didn't meet anybody in writing this book who said, here's a policy that if we enact, we'll make everyone get along, or it'll, you know, that nobody actually said that. Nobody said to me, once I enacted this policy, then I brought everyone together. And that never actually happened. They always said, no, it's about bringing people of difference together to have relationships and have conversation, build that social trust, and then you can make that policy progress, because we all know that's what we need. You've mentioned it already, climate change, so many issues, you know, across the board that where we have to have progress as a society. And so I tend to think, listen, there's a couple different camps. I'm in the camp that says that the politicians won't change until the voters change. And I think there's a lot of evidence for that. You know, there are some outliers, some examples of where, yes, the politicians can change the people. But in general, I don't think the politicians change till the people change. Do we need systemic political structural change in this country? Very possibly so. You know, as a journalist, it's not for me to make that argument. But I would say that, yeah, that's possibly what we need in the long run. But I'm realistic in realizing that it's not likely to happen in the short run. And so given the system we live with, we have to start working together, because our two-party system won't survive without it.
Yeah, sounds fair enough. So I, by the way, I really appreciate that you didn't tie it all together with a bow. It's, yeah. In other words, what you're saying is that there are people taking this on in their community, in their church, in, you know, yeah. And that's spreading. That's obviously a good thing. How to use that as a tipping point to shift national policy, when, as I said, there's certain things, as you were referring to, that conspire against it in the nature of the way we run politics these days, is fair. Let me just ask you final question. What should people read, listen to, do if they agree with, you know, sort of this movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of great books out there that really speak to similar issues. And I already mentioned, you know, Valerie Kaur's book, See No Stranger, which is fundamentally a memoir, but actually also talks about a lot of her thoughts on how to accomplish this. I mean, that is, I think, one of the best books I've read, where she says, you know, you are a part of me I do not yet know. And even if I don't agree with you, we can, you know, I need to understand you and I need to know you. And I find that to be a fascinating book, you know, there, and really speaks to a lot of the same things that I've written about on this topic. But I also think on the other side of the political spectrum, Arthur Brooks's book, Love Your Enemies, mm-hmm. you know, is actually really strong. And he dives deeply and he, you know, he, I think, is maybe a bit of a never Trump kind of Republican at this point. But I think that he understands the issue of how deeply affective polarization is afflicting this country. And so, you know, that's sort of on the other side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, honestly, you can't go wrong with a book like Don't Label Me by Irshad Manji, who really, you know, she's an amazing, you know, woman, a lesbian Muslim woman who is passionate about how to bring people together, and how when we label them, it's problematic. So, you know, there's so many books and such, but I could go on and on.
Yeah, we've got to bring this to a close. This is great, Nathan. I really appreciate the work that you've done. Again, the latest book is Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. The website is nathanbomey.com. That's Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, Bomey, B-O-M-E-Y, all one word, nathanbomey.com. You can also follow him at Twitter, at Nathan Bomey. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. Terrence McNally is TerrenceMcNally.net. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles of relevance, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com to add you to the list. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and most other major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts searchable by guest at my site, and you can listen anytime, anywhere, of course. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Nathan Bomey. Keep up your good work.
Thanks so much.